This is Thursday, May 20th, 2021. This interview for the Veterans Oral History Project, based at the Morse Institute Library in Natick, Massachusetts, is being recorded via Zoom. My name is Maureen Sullivan, Project Coordinator. This interview will be conducted by Jim Ramsey, volunteer at the Bedford VA Medical Center, and we are pleased to have with us today Vernon Amundson. Welcome, Vernon.
Thank you.
And Jim, it's all yours.
Well, thank you very much, Maureen. And let me also welcome Vernon. Vern, I think you prefer to be called Vern. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, well, that's how we'll take it from here. We'll get started with the interview. Vern, may I ask when you were born?
July 1635.
1935, okay. And where were you born, Vern?
Whitehall, Wisconsin.
Okay. And where did you grow up? In Whitehall or elsewhere?
No, Whitehall was just the town with the hospital. Family actually lived in Blair, and then they moved to Fargo, North Dakota. And I spent, well, from Fargo, I enlisted in the Air Force.
Fargo, okay, so you basically grew up then in Fargo, Vern?
Yes.
Okay. And did you have siblings as you were growing up?
Yes.
How many, what, brothers and sisters, I presume?
Brother and two brothers and two sisters.
Right. And so you and your brothers and sisters grew up in Fargo. You attended the public schools there, did you?
Yes.
I see. Okay. And so you joined the Air Force from Fargo?
Yeah.
Okay. And how old were you when you joined the Air Force? About when was that, Vern?
I was 18. So that would have been
1954 or so?
54.
Okay. So you joined, you joined the Air Force kind of when the Cold War was not so cold, right?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't remember.
Okay. I know that Russia and the United States were at each other following World War II, and of course you, I know, participated in that later. So you joined the Air Force. So you enlisted while you were at Fargo and then went to boot camp of some kind?
Lackland Air Force Base, Texas.
Lackland, that's where you went to boot camp?
Yes.
And what did you think about boot camp in Texas in the summertime?
Hot.
Yes. Oh, I presume you were in good shape and
And then I took a test and qualified for a program they called Aviation Cadets.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
So what was involved in that? Was that kind of a physical and mental type test or book type test?
The whole program, it lasted a year. And when you graduated, you were a commissioned officer and also an aviator. I was a navigator.
Okay, so you
a
came out of
second lieutenant.
That's how what you came out of aviation cadet training as?
That's how I went. Yeah.
Okay. So that training was about a year, was it?
Yes.
I see. So what did you study to become, how did you become a navigator?
By not qualifying to become a pilot.
So navigator was the default choice?
Yeah, they had something called a psychomotor test, and they had you do lots of stuff, and I didn't make it, so I was a navigator.
So the psychomotor test was required passage to become a pilot, and you...
I didn't pass it.
So
it was, you know, it was, they had you do different stuff. And one of them was they just sitting in a cockpit and you had pedals to control it to keep it on the even keel.
Yes.
And it was a little bit too long for me, and I had strained so much I couldn't do anything right after that. The next one was they had like a record player, and they had a stylus in your hand, and the object was to keep the stylus on that little sensor that was on this record.
Yep.
I did very, very poorly in that. So I was a navigator.
I see. Well, you know, a navigator sounds like a challenging enough job. I mean,
I was a little disappointed. You know, I wanted to be a pilot, but it didn't happen, so.
So why did you want to be a pilot? I mean, did you want to be a pilot?
Yeah.
When you were a kid?
Sure. Everybody does. Everybody does.
Well, that's interesting. I guess you're right. I mean, pilot is a pretty glamorous job up in the sky. But so did you do some additional training as a navigator to, you know, before your first assignment?
Well, yeah, it was 1 year.
Okay, so that included the navigator training.
Yeah.
Okay. So basically, after a year or so, like 55 or something like that, maybe 56.
56.
You graduated,
and I went over to Frankfurt, Germany.
Oh, you did. What was your assignment there, Vern? Or where were you? At an air base there?
Rhein-Main
Air Force Base, a big Air Force Base, right?
Yes.
And so you were.
It was the commercial base for Frankfurt.
Oh.
Rhein-Main was also the commercial base for Frankfurt.
So both the commercial base and a U.S. Air Force base.
Yes.
And so you were assigned to an aircraft or a squadron of some kind?
A squadron there, and we had C-130s.
C-130 airplane, which is basically a kind of a four-engine prop plane?
Yes, our mission was we were just a platform for a plane load of linguists, and we flew with the peripheral routes around Russia so they could listen in on military activity in Russia.
Huh. So this was a very important item, again, during the Cold War time, right?
Yes, it was.
So tell us a little bit about what it was like being a navigator on one of these one of these flights flying close to the Russian border.
Kind of boring.
But the navigator had a big job, right? I mean, you had to
keep us on this side of the border.
Right, because what would happen if you crossed the border?
They shoot us down.
Did they shoot planes down?
Yes, they did. We lost one.
You lost one to C-130?
Yeah. He stumbled across the border, you know, a navigational mistake, and they shot him down.
So there were a number of linguists on board the plane.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
So they were basically intercepting radio communications?
Correct.
Did you ever interact with those folks?
No, nothing whatsoever. They had about three, I'd say, little cubicles on board. One of them was, think it was called the phosphorus box. Anyway, it was the highly flammable metal. And when the Russians returned the bodies, of course, there were two missing because they were in that box that burned.
Oh, I see. Right. Some sort of phosphorus explosive or material that would, yeah.
Flammable. And
right.
There was nothing left of that one. When they returned the bodies, there were two bodies short because they'd burned up inside that box.
Wow. So that was a potentially hazardous duty you were on there.
Well, yeah, we just had to stay on this side of the border.
So
not cross over, you know.
Right. No, I understand. So did you ever have, so what did the Soviets do? What did they send up jets to intercept?
MiG-17s.
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 Did you ever have any close encounters of the MiG-17 kind?
I think we got chased out of the Black Sea once.
Really?
Yeah.
But were you?
We had some unusual winds, and you know, once you lost radar contact, it was easy to get to where you shouldn't have been. And
I see.
I went up there once, got awfully close to the Russian border, but we just turned south and went on across the Black Sea to Turkey.
So when you were chased by this MiG-17, did they threaten to shoot?
Well, I can only assume there was a MiG-17 chasing us, you know.
Because of what the pilot had to do to get out of there?
Yeah, we had to fly south, get back to Turkey.
Right. Now, you mentioned earlier, and you just mentioned Turkey. Did you also fly some of these missions out of a base in Turkey?
Incirlik Air Base, Adana, Turkey. In Adana, Turkey, Incirlik Air Base. Yes, we flew all the missions out of there. We would spend, the first 4 years that I spent in Frankfurt, Rhein-Main, about 1 year that was actually spent in Turkey.
A total of 1 year?
Out of the 4 years, about 1 year was down TDY, temporary duty in Turkey.
Okay. But that was spread out over the 4 years, right? Or was it all, right?
Spread out.
Did you fly, you flew some missions out of Frankfurt and some missions out of Turkey?
Right.
Okay. So how many missions did you fly? Do you know? On that job?
No, I don't know. Hundreds.
And how frequently, I mean, did you basically fly a mission and then you were off for a couple of days, or?
We flew about, from when we were in Turkey, we flew about every third day.
Every third day?
About every third day, I think.
So you had a fair amount of time off.
Oh, yeah.
What did you do in your time off?
Drank beer.
Well, good, especially in Frankfurt. I mean, what else are you going to do in Frankfurt?
But down in Turkey, too. They had places called the Habus Pavilion, which were really just giant taverns.
I see. So how does the Turkish beer compare with the German beer?
It was German beer there.
German beer in Turkey?
Yes.
Aha. Uh-huh. So you had German beer no matter what?
You bet.
Did you get a chance to travel, I mean, separately around Europe much when you were on this assignment?
Oh, yes.
And did you
traveled a lot? favorite was Bavaria, of course.
Yes. So it sounds like, were there any especially kind of memorable characters or fellow, you know, crew members or whatever that you remember, or incidents from all of this that you'd like to recount for us?
Yeah, I was, you know, I was traveling on vacation down in Bavaria, and I climbed the Matterhorn.
What? The Matterhorn?
The Matterhorn, the mountain.
Huh.
That was pretty exciting.
That sounds like, so you actually had the climbing gear and the ropes and all that stuff, or?
Had a guide. He said, keep your hands off the ropes.
I see.
If you slip, just keep reaching me. Don't pull me off this mountain.
My goodness. Was it just you and a guide, or?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So you are an adventurer.
Yeah, I would say so.
Did you make it to the top of the Matterhorn?
Sure did.
My goodness. Well, good
for
you.
Physically very strenuous climb.
Right. But you were in good shape.
Pretty good.
Yep.
Well, I recall a school teacher with another guide kind of passed me up at the very end. So she was in better shape than I was.
Wow. Well, that's pretty cool. I the Matterhorn is a very prominent mountain, certainly. It's a beautiful mountain.
Yes, it is.
And so.
It's a strange thing when you get on top. It looks, you know, you could stand on top and just look down there. You know, down the side, but if you dropped anything, the illusion was that it was floating out away from you.
Huh.
I thought it was really strange.
Really?
You're standing right there looking down the mountain, but if you dropped anything, it just floated out into space.
Wow. So had you ever climbed a mountain before?
No.
Have you ever climbed one since?
No.
Well, congratulations.
One shot deal.
Very good. So you were basically, were you part of the same crew for your whole, for your first tour there at Rhein Main?
No. The crews switched around a little bit. So I was on quite a number of different crews.
And what was the total number of, what was the size of the crew, not including the linguists on the C-130?
Pilot, co-pilot, engineer, navigator. Actually, we had two navigators.
Two navigators?
Yeah. You wanted to make sure that we knew where we were going.
Particularly because of the sensitivity of the Russian border?
Correct.
So what were you, sitting right next to each other, just kind of checking each other's work?
Yeah, we both maintained a nav log.
A nav log.
Right next to each other.
Wow. Two separate logs?
Yeah.
Well, so.
We tried combining them for a while, but they said no to that. Keep your own, you know. Want to make sure that we get two sets of eyes, make damn sure you don't cross over that Russian border.
Wow. So how long did you do this? I know you told me before you actually were at Rhein Main a couple of times.
Four years.
4 years was your first tour.
Yep.
So you started off as a second lieutenant.
Yep.
Were you promoted to, what were you, first lieutenant when you, at the end of that tour?
Yeah, but first lieutenant comes almost automatically a year and a half after you're a second.
Okay, right.
You get to be
right.
First lieutenant,
right.
And I had graduated from aviation cadets when I was under 21. I was just 20 years old, so I got promoted to first lieutenant, and I had to wait to be promoted to captain because of age.
Oh, I see.
So the reason they did that is they didn't want anybody getting ahead of the academy graduates, which come out at, you know, like 21.
The Air Force Academy.
Yeah.
So when did you, were you promoted to captain by the time you finished at Rhein-Main, or did that come a little later?
A little later.
Okay.
Probably a year or so later.
So after 4 years at Rhein-Main and reconnaissance, where to then?
I think it was Wright-Patterson.
Wright-Patterson Air Force Base?
Yes.
Which is located where?
Columbus, Ohio.
Columbus, Ohio. So, let's see. And what did you do at Wright-Patterson?
We flew B-52s.
I see. You flew. Let's see. We talked about this before. I think you said before you got the B-52s, I think you were involved with C-141s. Was that observing the returning satellites or the returning rockets?
Yeah. We tried to position the aircraft to catch the signature of the incoming rocket. Incoming missile.
So this was a C-141?
No, 135. C-135.
Oh, okay. C-135.
We had two aircraft, and you know, they'd cut big holes in the fuselage and filled them with these quartz windows, and one of the aircraft exploded over the Pacific and went down. So we're down to one.
So you were on one, and there was another one, and that one exploded.
Yeah.
Why did it explode, Vern?
Structural damage to the aircraft when they put in those quartz windows. You know, they took out structural rigidity of the aircraft, and you know, had those windows, and anyway, they gave way.
So you were explaining to me when we talked earlier, this was basically a project to photograph the return of this rocket?
Yes.
So you had sophisticated camera gear this time?
That's correct. We had the specialists on board photographing through these quartz windows.
So this sounds like another highly specialized type of assignment for a navigator.
Yeah, we had, we'd be out there flying in a little orbit, and they'd give us a time that the missile took off, and then we'd figure out exactly where we had to be to catch the maximum amount of time on a missile. And that was very tight. Guys in the back, you know, they were photographing through these quartz windows. Right. They could tell if we're 10 seconds off.
Huh. So was it your responsibility to do all these calculations?
That's right.
Did you have another navigator with you, or was this a solo responsibility?
It was solo then. It was just, yeah, I was alone.
So you basically, where were the missiles fired from?
Vandenberg Air Force Base, California. They gave us a liftoff time, and then we figured when they were going to get there, we had to position ourselves to, so that these guys standing behind the quartz windows would get maximum amount of time, re-entry time.
So the objective was to photograph the missile as it returned
into
the Earth's atmosphere?
Right.
What was your altitude at the time? About?
35,000.
Oh, okay. So the missile, by the time it got to where you were looking at it, it was returning, it was headed for the ground.
Yep.
So you actually did the calculation on basically where and when the missile would be.
That is correct. Our object was to get us right in position. So when that thing entered, the guys standing behind these quartz windows would get a picture of it.
And they actually got a physical picture of the missile?
That's correct.
So what was the purpose of all of this? I mean, why do this?
It was to, well, they wanted that so that they knew what they were exposing, letting the Russians know about what the missile would look like when it returned.
So was this, I think you were talking before, was this part of a program to develop a kind of a missile defense system?
Yes, it was.
Okay, so basically, if at least theoretically, the U.S. could intercept a return or an incoming Russian missile and destroy it before it hit?
No, they wanted to get information as to what the Russians could see when our missile came in.
Oh, I got it. Oh, okay. So this would be the perspective that the Russians would have.
Yeah.
On our missiles.
Right.
Okay. So how many of these flights did you undertake? I mean, a lot of them, or?
Oh yeah. We had two aircraft equipped, you know, with the big quartz windows. And like I said, they kind of removed the integrity of the body of the aircraft when they put the windows in, and one of them exploded over the Pacific and, you know, went down.
Right. So
we were left with just one aircraft to do that job.
So how many, so you basically had the same kind of crew on the C-130, and then you had a couple of specialists who were manning the cameras?
Right.
Did the plane fly differently because of these changes to the structure?
Only one. Only one.
It flew very differently, unfortunately, right?
Well, like I said, when they put the windows in, they had kind of removed the integrity of the aircraft shell itself. So anyway, one of them didn't make it.
So what were your thoughts after this? I mean, I'm sure you probably knew the folks on the crew of the plane, which must have been a...
Yeah, my buddy that sat with me in, you know, back on the ground in Napa was one of the guys on the aircraft that exploded it.
Wow. But basically your crew had to keep going up. What did you think about that? I mean, were you a little bit concerned about that?
No.
No.
It for you was just his bad luck.
Okay. Well, you were young then and
fearless.
And fearless. Wow. Just like on the Matterhorn.
Yeah.
Wow. So you were out of Wright-Patterson, but I think you said actually that you told me earlier you were doing these observations by flying out of Hickam Air Base in Hawaii?
Yeah, I think, yeah, we were flying out of Hickam then. Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Okay, but then...
Can't remember everything. I think it was.
Okay, but then, so would you occasionally go back as a group to Wright-Patterson, or did you basically stay at Hickam?
Stayed at Hickam for a long time. Actually, we went to Anderson Air Force Base in Guam.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. We flew out of Guam a lot.
for this same mission with regard to the photography?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think so. I can't remember now.
Okay, but in any event, someplace in the Pacific, you were observing these returning missiles.
Yeah.
Right. So how long did you do that, Vern? A few years?
It wasn't very long. Yeah, probably about a couple of years.
Okay.
And then I went back into B-52s and...
Oh, you, okay.
Out of Guam.
I missed that last bit. So after the C-135, you flew B-52s, did you?
Yes.
Wow. Is there any plane bigger than a B-52?
Well, yeah, they're cargo planes. I guess C-141 is pretty big. C-5 is big, and I think they're... Right. I think there's a C-17 now. It's huge.
But the B-52, the B-52, that has like 8 engines, right?
Yep.
So where were you, so after you finished with the missile observations, you went to B-52s. Where were you assigned for this?
Guam.
Okay. Well, I think you mentioned initially that perhaps your first B-52 assignment was at Westover Air Force Base.
Westover, right.
And what were B-52s doing in Westover?
Standing alert.
I mean, I would guess
we had targets in Russia. We were standing alert. If anything happened, we could fly from Westover straight into Russia. We had assigned targets.
Wow. Okay. So basically Westover, I mean, was it basically a big B-52 base?
Yeah, I think. Yeah. There are quite a few aircraft there.
And I wasn't living in Massachusetts at the time, but I wonder how many people in Massachusetts were aware of what was going on at Westover. That sounds like pretty serious stuff.
Well, the people around Westover is in Chicopee, Mass, you know, which is right next to Springfield. Sure, the people around there did.
Well, they had to, I guess, because the plane's pretty obvious when a B-52 takes off or lands.
Yeah, we were standing alert there.
So this was an alert in the event of a Soviet attack.
Correct.
So basically, this was like a 24-hour alert. I mean, all times something was ready to go.
Yep. You know, the individual crews were only on alert for, you know, probably a couple of days, and then they'd be off flying their regular missions.
Okay, and I think, although we haven't kept totally accurate track of the timeline, but I think you told me before that by the time you were there, it was around 67 or 68.
I don't remember.
Right, and I that sounds about right. So, and what you recall what the unit was that you were assigned to there at Westover? Was it the 99th Bombardment Wing?
99th, yes.
Which was part of the Strategic Air Command, right?
General Curtis LeMay.
Who was the commanding general?
Yeah.
Of SAC?
Yes.
Strategic Air Command, right.
Yeah.
Did you ever have the opportunity to meet General LeMay?
No, didn't want to.
Why not?
He was a jerk.
Okay. I know he was a very opinionated, outspoken guy.
He ran for vice president later, remember, if you remember.
I do remember.
Didn't do very well, but, you know, he couldn't speak well. He was not a politician, you know, he was a general.
Right.
But he didn't do well.
So basically, though, you were on alert. So therefore, presumably, there were nuclear weapons that you were basically carrying or prepared to carry to the Soviet Union.
We carried them.
You carried them.
Yeah.
So how did that work? They were on the planes or placed on the plane. I guess they had to be activated somehow, or?
They were loaded and armed while we were on alert. We would fly, you know, our missions across the Atlantic and do a little orbiting in the Mediterranean Sea.
I see. So you were kind of back in the same area where you were before doing the reconnaissance work.
Yep.
Over close to the Soviet Union.
Yep.
And so you go up. So was there a refueling thing involved in this, or did you just fly out and fly back?
No, we had I'm pretty sure we had to refuel. I can't remember exactly, but I'm pretty sure we had refueling.
In mid-air.
Yeah.
Right. Did you ever kind of worry much about sort of the import or impact of this job you had, or your, you know?
No. That was a pilot's job, so you get fuel.
No, right. No, I know. I mean, in-air fueling is a challenging thing in and of itself. I'm really referring to your mission of, you know, carrying and possibly dropping nuclear weapons. That must have been that's a big responsibility.
Yeah, we had to learn our targets very well and prove to, you know, a bunch of colonels that we, where the hell we were going to go.
So you had.
That was a big deal. Yeah.
So you had to be, there had to be absolute certainty that the bombs would be dropped in the right place if they had to be dropped.
Correct.
So how frequently would you go out to, on one of these, I mean, these were practice missions, right? Just
right.
To kind of stay in shape?
Right. Oh, I don't remember. I suppose that in the time we're on alert, we might make one of these runs once every two tours on alert.
Okay.
But I don't remember.
So you were on alert for a certain period of time, and then you were basically off alert?
Right.
So how long?
Somebody was always on alert, but we only had to
understand
X number of days. And we'd go back to just flying regular missions.
So how long were you on alert for at one time?
It changed over the time, but I think it wound up about 7 days.
Okay.
Days on alert.
So basically, during that time, you had to be basically ready to be what, on that plane within?
Right.
Within some period, some number of minutes?
Yeah, just a few. Just a few minutes.
Just a few minutes.
Yeah.
So essentially, you were basically right close by the plane, somewhere close by the plane for 7 straight days.
Yeah, they had the facility, living facilities were right next to the plane, really.
So did you, guess the same thing here that I asked before. Were you basically part of the same crew for your for your tour at Westover?
Yeah. Yeah, they tried to keep the same crew.
Right, I would think that they
sometimes we change, but generally it was the same crew.
Are you, just out of curiosity, are you still in any kind of contact with, you know, with the crew members that you were with?
No.
I see. So when you were in Westover, had you made captain by that time, Vern?
Yeah, somewhere along there.
Right. Well, it sounds like you, I mean, I know a navigator's job on an airplane is a very, very important one, but it sounds like in all of these jobs you've had, you really had some critical responsibilities here.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of keeping away from Russia or being right when the missile came down, I guess I'm inferring that you must have been a highly skilled navigator.
I think so.
Good. That's fantastic. So, okay, so if it was around 67 when you started, maybe you were there doing that for a couple of years at Westover?
Probably. I don't recall, but probably.
I understand. And by that time, Vietnam was heating up, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Vietnam had already become in the news in the, I guess, the mid-60s. By 69, it was pretty strong. And I think you talked about Anderson Air Force Base in Guam. Is that, that's where you went next?
Yeah. Yeah, I was stationed there for quite a while.
And what did you do? What were you involved in that assignment, Vern?
Flying B-52s.
Oh.
So and manning them when they're on alert.
Okay, but this was, let's see, so this was in Guam. So was this basically the B-52 bombing and it was going on in Vietnam?
Yeah.
Wow. So how far is it, by the way? What? How long a flight is it from Guam to Vietnam?
Flights were a little over 12 hours from Guam to Guam.
Wow, 12 hours one way?
No.
One
way.
One way, okay. So, so you would basically take off from Guam with a load of bombs, not nuclear weapons, but conventional weapons.
Conventional, yeah.
And what were those weapons? What were those bombs?
500 pounders and 750 pounders.
And you basically
a total of about 100 of them per load.
100 bombs in the plane.
Some were on the wings. 750s are on the wings. I think it was about 12 out there, and the rest were interior 500s. But total load of about 100.
So some were mounted on the wings, and some were in the belly of the plane.
Right.
Okay. So what was the crew for this bombing activity? Did you have a bombardier, or?
Yeah, that was me.
What? That was you?
Yeah. Navigator was also the bombardier.
Oh, okay. So you did both. So, okay. So you took off from Guam. 12-hour flight's a long flight. Did you require refueling?
Yes.
So basically,
tankers were out of Okinawa.
Okinawa.
Yeah.
So the tankers with aviation fuel would come to meet you, and you
a rendezvous point, and I as navigator on the 52 would bring them in from where, you know, from their takeoff in Okinawa, I'd bring them into the rendezvous points so pilot could get up and get his gas.
So you basically were responsible for directing not only yes. your plane, but also the refueling plane.
That is correct.
Huh. Ever have any sort of exciting encounters with this refueling, or did they always go very smoothly? It looked like a very tricky operation.
It was, but the pilot is, you know, pretty skilled.
I bet he is.
So he could handle it.
I see. So so basically one in-air refueling on the way over.
That's probably one on the way back too. So, but you know, the pilot only had to get it up to a, you know, a certain position underneath there, and then from then on, the guy in the tanker had a boom and a flying boom, so to speak, and he would plug it in.
So
the
basically,
pilot only had to get it so close, and then the guy in the tanker would stick that boom out there and grab the gas.
So, okay. So so basically the planes got in position with each other, and then the final step was to maneuver the boom into the bomber to be able to load the gas.
Correct.
Still sounds pretty hairy.
It was at times.
So how long did the refueling operation last?
Probably less than 30 minutes.
But during that time, obviously, both planes had to fly exactly the same speed, the same position.
That is correct.
And were you basically making sure that happened, or did the pilots just know what to do?
That was the pilot's job at that point. Once I got them together, that was his job.
So your job was to get the planes together.
Right.
Then the two pilots' jobs was to stay together the required time.
The pilot of the B-52 and then the boom operator of the 135.
I see. So where'd the boom operator, was he sitting in the back of the tanker?
Yes, he had a laying down position so he could see everything, you know.
Huh. Okay, but
fly that boom right down into the receptacle.
So were you in a squadron of B-52s or a group going over as a group?
It was a whole squadron of us out of over there.
So how many planes in a squadron?
Oh, yeah, I don't know.
I mean, five or six?
No, probably 10 or 12.
Huh. So you'd essentially all take off together and all, so.
No. Well, they flew separately.
Oh, so you didn't fly in formation?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. When we had our missions out of Guam, we had three ship formations.
Okay. And so those four.
Three ships.
I'm sorry.
Three aircraft.
Three aircraft flew together.
Yeah.
So there were like four sets of three aircraft flying as part of this mission?
I guess so.
Okay, anyway, it doesn't. But anyway, for your set of so were there three refueling tankers for your three planes?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
So after you arrived, so you got to Vietnam, were you bombing both in North and South Vietnam, Vern?
No, just South.
And just. Obviously, so you, before you took off, you had an assignment that you were given, or did you receive your assignment while in the air?
We knew where we were going. We knew where we were going.
Okay.
In South Vietnam. We only went north once, you know, at the very end. Went up and bombed Hanoi and Haiphong.
Okay. Okay. But you basically left Anderson with the game plan for exactly where you'd be bombing, or were you given direction?
No, we were flying out of Guam.
Right.
At that time. Flying out of Guam.
I guess what I'm asking is, was there an air traffic? I mean, was there somebody on the ground, a fire control, somebody who was?
Yes, there was in Vietnam.
And what did they, I mean, did they basically direct exactly where it was you would drop the bombs?
Yes, they did.
And as you said, you were the bombardier, right?
Yep.
So, you had, or did you have, direct communication then with this fire control person on the ground?
Yes.
Okay. What elevation, what altitude were you, did you drop the bombs from, roughly?
About 35,000.
So
35,000 feet.
So the ground, the person on the ground would basically give you coordinates or something as to where to drop?
Yeah, well, he had radar that would, you know, it would, and he told us where to go.
Right. So how did you actually, I mean, is there something that you program in to the bomb release that lets you know exactly when you have to release them? I mean, how does that work?
They just told me when to drop them.
Okay, so they tell you when to drop them, and that's when you dropped them. You dropped them all at once?
Yeah. Most of the time we did that, and then later they started to split the loads up so we could, we'd make two paths over the same area. Probably half a load and half a load.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why they did that, but it was the first time I get it scared the devil out of me because I saw that just half of the bombs had dropped and I forgot what I was doing for a second.
And
I said, holy cats, I got half a load left. And I said, wait a minute, that's what I'm supposed to have. But scared the devil out of me for about a second and a half.
So basically then you came back around and dropped the other half?
Right.
I see. Were you within anti-aircraft range?
No. No, we didn't get into anti-aircraft range at all, except when we went north to Hanoi and Haiphong. There was missiles then.
Uh-huh.
SAM-2 missiles the Russians supplied them with.
Yes.
Yeah, they were. I was in a plane that had, we dodged one of them going into the target. I mean, it was coming right up at us. We got out of the way.
How do you dodge a missile?
Quickly. Quickly. You know, co-pilot would see it. And he'd yell at the pilot and he'd take his maneuvers to get out of the way of that sucker.
So you could actually see it coming?
Oh, yeah.
Were these?
No, they hit. I can recall just one missile that took out a B-52, and crew had to bail out.
Over North Vietnam.
Yeah, well, it's over water, but yeah.
So that was only, that the only one that you're aware of?
Where yeah, 52 yeah, just one. And of course it couldn't have been, it had to have been a near miss on the missile, otherwise the aircraft would have been gone, but there wouldn't have been any bailout, but must have been a near miss because the aircraft, your air crew did bail out.
Okay. So the plane was damaged in some way, so the crew got out, but it wasn't a direct hit.
Couldn't have been. It wouldn't have been the bailout.
Well, so you all basically, the whole crew was equipped with parachutes?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
What kind of parachute training did you receive?
Oh, early on, you know, in the training, they had some.
I see. We do.
Some stuff that we sit in a little seat like it, squeeze the trigger, and this thing would jump to the top of the rail and simulate a.
So basically, you.
Yes, departure from the aircraft.
You learned this early on, and then you basically. So basically, all of your assignments when you were on these various planes, did you always have a parachute?
Yeah.
Okay.
Always.
So I think you you told me this. How many hours did you have flying B-52s?
I think I got about 2,000 hours.
And you also told me how many you think you had flying C-130s
over 3,000.
3,000
hours.
And you also said, I mean, I know you've flown other things. Your total hours is, you said something like 8,000?
Somewhere around there.
That's a lot of hours in the air.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
So you did the B-52 bombing out of Anderson Air Force Base.
Yep.
For what, a year or so, and then I think you told me that you you had another navigation mission in Vietnam related to the gunships.
119, yeah.
What's that?
119.
The one.
119K was the gunship.
That's the AC.
That's a World War II cargo plane. 119.
Basically, the AC-119K.
Yeah.
And what was that about? What was the function of that plane?
That was a gunship. We had four. A total of six guns in here. Four. Four gun things. And two 7.62s and two 20 millimeter Gatling guns.
They were basically Gatling guns, right?
Yeah.
So what was the purpose of these planes with their guns?
Protect the hill stations of the Pathet Lao. In winter time, he'd move down and capture a couple of hills, and then we would protect those. And the other season, he got chased off the hill, and we didn't have to go there.
So was this along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, or?
Is it? Yeah, I suppose you could call it that. In the middle of Laos.
In the middle of Laos.
Yeah.
So basically you were going after the North Vietnamese
yeah.
in Laos with this. So.
Oh, when they came south, yeah.
Right. So this was a very different kind of thing from flying at 35,000 feet in a B-52.
Yes, quite different.
What altitude were you flying at with these with the AC-119s?
I think it was around 3,000 feet, something like that.
And you were the navigator on these as well, right?
Correct.
So you were flying out of a base in South Vietnam, were you, or were you?
Thailand.
Oh. Okay.
We flew out of Thailand.
Out of Thailand.
Yeah. Udorn.
Udorn.
Yeah, Udorn Air Base, I think Thailand, yeah.
Okay. And essentially you were going after like troops and trucks, equipment?
Yep.
And I thought
I had spotted a whole bunch of trucks once and we opened fire on them. Turned out to be a herd of elephants. A herd of buffalo.
A herd of water buffalo?
Water buffalo, but they scattered.
Did you have any kills?
I hope not.
No one
wants to kill a water buffalo.
I'm sure you didn't want to do that. Well, that...
No. It was a mistake, you know. I just thought, oh my goodness, look at all those trucks down there. There weren't trucks, there were water buffalo.
That's quite a story. So you basically were obviously close enough that you could... I mean, were you basically flying around looking for?
We were looking for vehicles.
Vehicles.
Yeah.
And again, were you being directed by someone on the ground, or were you just up?
We were just up on our own.
So
up on our own then.
So were you, so who was responsible? I mean, again, there was what, a pilot and a co-pilot? And who else on the crew?
The gunners.
So you had gunners on the crew.
And myself, the crew chief and myself.
Okay, how many gunners, two?
Four.
Four.
Four. And there were actually three navigators on board. One was manning something called a FLIR, which was a forward-looking radar. And the other was a NAS, which was a night scope. It was mounted out in the doorway, the entrance of the aircraft. That was my position. I stood on a steel plate that was supposed to protect me from
ground fire?
Ground fire, yeah.
So you stood on a steel plate manning this?
Yeah, manning this, something called NAS, a night scope.
So were these missions generally flown at night or?
Yes.
Night and?
Night.
Night.
Always night, always night.
Always night.
Yeah.
So you must have gotten shot at, I would guess.
Oh, yes. Matter of fact, one of the missions when they went a little bit further north than we usually flew, one of the aircraft got 16 feet of its wing shot off, and the pilot still managed to bring it back and land it safely.
Really?
Yeah.
So you typically flew in a like a group of you of these gunships?
No, just one at a time.
One at a time?
Yeah.
So describe a close call that you might have had. if you can recall one.
Well, like you said, the one aircraft got its wing shot off. That was one.
Was that one that you were on?
No, I wasn't on it, no. We have, you know, maybe 3 or 4 missions per night. And this was just one of them. And then there was another incident where they got fired on the, just as they were landing. And the co-pilot got his foot shot off.
Huh.
Yeah.
This was landing back at the base at Udorn in Thailand?
Yeah. No, it couldn't have been there. It didn't fly in there.
Might have been there might have been bases in South Vietnam too, huh?
Yeah. I don't remember.
Okay.
All I remember is that we got hit just twice.
You got hit twice?
No, I said our outfit got hit twice.
I see. That sounds like pretty exciting duty.
It was.
And so did you do that for a year or so, Vern?
I can't remember.
That's okay. I think when we talked about this earlier, you said it was about that, but I think you also said that when that assignment was over, that you went back to the B-52s?
Yeah.
Operating again out of Anderson?
Yeah.
So that was back to the high level, high altitude bombing again?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was with Anderson.
Well, I think that, you know, I know the time kind of fades here, and you had a long and very exciting career. This took it, us, I, huh, pardon me?
It was a good one.
Yep, it sure was. I think we figured that at one point that it was around 1972 or so when you completed this, your missions in Vietnam, and you started in 54, so that probably accounted for 18 of your, I think you had a 25-year career in the Air Force.
Yes, is that 25 years.
Right, so you basically continued in the Air Force from that point, I guess, 1972
I don't remember what I did then. I just can't remember the very end.
Well, you've done a great job remembering these, certainly your exciting, your first 18 years. And you retired, I guess, in 1979? Does that sound about right?
Yeah, about right, probably.
And you, at that point, your rank was a major?
Yes.
So you had 25 years in. You started, you enlisted boot camp. You went to aviation cadet training, became an officer, and you were a navigator throughout your career.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for telling us about your military service. I have a couple of, what's that?
You're welcome.
Oh, thank you. Let me just get at some couple of questions here about after your military service. So where were you when you were discharged from the Air Force?
I don't recall. Could have been Dyess Air Force Base.
And where is that, Vern?
Abilene, Texas.
Oh, okay. And at that point, again, you were discharged as a major.
Yeah.
And then at that point, you became a civilian for the first time in a long time.
Yep.
Where did you go then? I mean, where was home? Or was there a place that you could call home?
I think we just stayed there in Columbus.
In Columbus, Ohio?
Yeah.
Okay, where Wright-Patterson was.
Right.
Okay. So by that point, you were married?
Yeah.
Right. And how long did you, so was Columbus your home for some time?
Yeah, I guess so. Second wife died when she was 65. That was at Columbus.
Okay, and I neglected to ask you at the beginning, but just to kind of complete the personal questions a little bit, you are married, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Married to my third wife.
Right. You explained, unfortunately, that your first two wives passed away.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. And you have children? How many kids do you have?
Six.
Six children?
Yes.
And I believe you told me that they're kind of located all over the country.
Correct.
And how about grandchildren, Vern?
I think it's four of them. Okay. I don't even know.
Well, anyway, so you eventually wound up, I guess, back in the Northeast. Did you came to the Boston area, or I know I think your wife now is in Salem. You lived for some, you were in the banking profession, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you were a banker. You lived in, I know you had a home in Massachusetts. And your wife is now in Salem. So I guess as you think back on your military service, you know, how important was that service to you in your life?
Very important. Loved every minute of it.
You loved every minute of it.
That's yep.
I know you've said that. You know, I mean, how would you say it affected your life? Obviously, 25 years is a big chunk of time, so it must have. But you know, how would you describe it?
Wonderful. Wonderful.
So you liked every bit of it.
Yep.
Even the boot camp part.
Ah, piece of cake.
Well, good. So just kind of a couple of recapping questions here. Looking back on it all, was there a most memorable experience in your career? You know, someplace, a memorable character, something that happened, something humorous that you'd like to share with us?
No, I had a grand time over in Europe, the first tour at Rhein. Spent 4 years there. That was a grand time.
Including climbing the Matterhorn.
Yeah, that was fun.
But you enjoyed Europe a lot.
I did.
You think of any one of your crew members or commanding officers or anybody who made a special impression on you or? I know General LeMay made an impression on you.
Yeah. Oh, there's a guy named Colonel Crowley.
Uh-huh.
He's quite a guy.
Was he your commanding officer at some point?
Yes.
Where?
Toward the end. He had an assignment to University of Oklahoma, I think, to command the cadets there.
Oh, well, like at ROTC?
Yeah. Yeah, he was a fantastic guy.
So was that one of your assignments tied into ROTC?
No. No, he retired. He left there from Rhein-Main.
Ah.
To the university.
So were you with him when you were in Germany?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, that's great. So as you know, there's a video being made of this interview. Is there any thought that you'd like to leave with your wife or your kids, family, in terms of your reflections on your service? Any last thought?
I enjoyed every minute of it. I enjoyed every minute of it. I thought it was great.
Well, that's fantastic. Vern, this has been a great interview.
Thank you.
We really appreciate the time that you've spent with us. And in closing, I'll say thank you, Vernon Harley Amundson, for participating in this program today. Thank you.
You're welcome.